First of all, I want to thank everybody for coming, for watching blogs and Craigslist and upcoming and boing boing and all sorts of stuff to hear about the event tonight. It's going to be the first of many because we here at Variety Children's Charity of Northern California have partnered with notable lights in the science fiction, fantasy, and horror field, such as our esteemed authors tonight, if I may say. I just want to tell you folks a little bit what and who Variety Children's Charity of Northern California is. We are an international charity organization that was founded in 1927 in Pittsburgh, PA, where a destitute mother with a small child she couldn't take care of, and this is the gospel truth, left her child in a theater that was run by the Variety Syndicate with a note that said to the effect, "I have always heard theater people had kind hearts. Would you please look after my little girl?" And she was found after a performance. The producers, after, I don't know, like 2 seconds deliberation, decided that what they were going to do is when this girl was placed in an orphanage, they were going to make sure she was taken care of for the rest of her life. They gave money to the orphanage. It spread into a huge philanthropic endeavor. And if you've heard of Variety, the movie Rag, it's the same organization. Only we are the charity of choice for the motion picture industry, hence the motion picture theater. And we have chapters in just about every country in the world. And when I joined Variety Children's Charity as a board member about 5 years ago, at that point, to date, Variety had given away about $9 billion over the course of all these years in various endeavors to disadvantaged, at-risk, handicapped, developmentally disabled, children in need, in trouble, wherever the need was greatest. And each chapter, or tent as they're called, hearkening back to the vaudeville days, kind of unfortunately, but our executive directors are called Barkers, so it really is, they're not too thrilled with that and prefer executive director. But at any rate, we are going strong. We don't want to be the best kept secret in San Francisco. We've been here since 1967. The theater room is rented out to movie studios, reviewers. They come here and watch the movies that you read the review in the Chronicle each week, and we do Academy Award screenings here. The number one thing that I love about Variety is pretty much 100% of all monies raised go directly to the children. All of our operating costs are paid for by the rental of this room, by the rental of this room for events such as this, birthday parties, kids screenings, business events, you name it, and the room pretty much can accommodate it. So we, Variety Children's Charity, is partnered with Tachyon Publications. Jacob Weissman, the publisher, is here tonight, along with one of his authors, Ellen Clages, who has a new book out called Portable Childhoods. It's a short story collection.
Very good book.
And Terry Bisson, who is our marvelous moderator tonight. And going forward, too, we're going to be doing this once a month. So if you saw a sign-up sheet up at the front, that'll get you notice about SF and SF events, events at Borderlands Books, other movie, other SF-related things happening here at Variety's Children's Charity. So without further ado, Terry Bisson.
Okay. Well, we're starting off a new season. We were sort of out of it for a little while, but we're back, as Rena said, thanks to Tachyon Children's Charity. I'll explain some of the background of SF and SF later on. Right now, let's get to what we came here to do. This our first reader tonight, we have two readers tonight, and our first reader has kindly consented to join us from his perambulations around the world and around the internet. I think you all know who he is. He's an open source wizard. He's I would say an agitator and an outlaw in terms of copyright and for what I'd call the open source world, which is waiting around the corner. But we'll talk about that when we get to our panel discussion. He has the way I first knew this guy was as a writer, and as a very careful, precise, imaginative, and, as it turns out, quite popular best-selling author of modern science fiction, who has now won a number of awards and has a number of books out, which I won't go into because we'll talk about it later. But I'd like to welcome and turn the floor over to Cory Doctorow.
Thank you. Thanks.
I was the only one who, when I heard about the Oscar screenings here, I thought, wow, it's just like Oscar torrents, but in the real world. So I'm going to read to you a little, for those of you who hear my podcast, this is a bit of a repeat, I'm sorry to say, although I'm hoping to do the reading a little differently. I'm going to read to you a little from a novel that I've got coming out next May, so a year from now, called Little Brother. It's a novel, a young adult novel about hacker kids in San Francisco who are up playing an alternate reality game in this neighborhood. When someone blows up the Bay Bridge, and the Department of Homeland Security takes them away and treats them very shabbily, and one of them is never released. And in the wake of this, they declare war on the Department of Homeland Security and have pitched battles in the streets of San Francisco involving all sorts of technology. And every chapter explains in some detail what technology they use. It's all contemporary technology you can build yourself. And actually, Instructables will be doing Instructables based on this, so you can build this stuff and do it yourself. So I'll just interject notes of background as I go in this reading. The book will be out next May. It's called Little Brother. And here we go. People started to drift into Dolores Park through the long Sunday afternoon, showing up among the ultimate Frisbee players and the dog walkers. Some of them played Frisbee and walked dogs. It wasn't really clear how the concert was going to work, but there were a lot of cops and undercovers hanging around. You could tell the undercovers because, like Zit and Booger, two cops he'd had a run-in with the day before, like Zit and Booger, they had Castro haircuts and Nebraska physiques. Tubby guys with short hair and untidy mustaches. They drifted around, looking awkward and uncomfortable in their giant shorts and loose-fitting shirts that no doubt hung down to cover the chandelier of gear hung around their midriffs. Dolores Park is pretty and sunny, with palm trees, tennis courts, and lots of hills and regular trees to run around on or hang out under. Homeless people sleep there at night, but that's true everywhere in San Francisco. I met Ange down the street at the Anarchist Bookstore. That had been my suggestion. In hindsight, it was a really totally transparent move to seem cool and edgy to this girl, but at the time I would have sworn that I picked it because it was a convenient place to meet up. She was reading a book called Up Against the Wall, Motherfucker, when I got there. Nice, I said. You kiss your mother with that mouth? Your mother doesn't complain, she said. Actually, it's the history of a group of people like the Yippies, but from New York. They all used motherfucker as their last names, like Ben Motherfucker. The idea was to have a group out there making news, but with this totally unprintable name, just to screw around with the news media. It was pretty funny, really. She put the book back on the shelf, and now I wondered if I should hug her. People in California hug to say hello and goodbye all the time, except when they don't, and sometimes they kiss on the cheek. It's all very confusing. She settled it for me by grabbing me in a long hug and tugging my head down to her, kissing me hard on the cheek, then blowing a fart on my neck. I laughed and pushed her away. You want a burrito, I asked. Is that a question or a statement of the obvious, she said. Neither, I said. It's an order. I bought some funny stickers that said, "This phone is tapped," which were the right size to put on the receivers of the payphones that still line the streets of the Mission, it being the kind of neighborhood where you got people who couldn't necessarily afford a cell phone. We walked out into the night air. I told Ange about the scene at the park when I left. I bet they have 100 of those trucks parked around the block, she said, the better to bust you with. I looked around. I sort of hoped that you would say something like, there's no chance they'll do anything about it. I don't really think that's the idea, she said. The idea is to put a lot of civilians in a position where the cops have to decide, are we going to treat these ordinary people like terrorists? It's a little like the jamming. Jamming is the technological jamming they do. It's a little like the jamming, but with music instead of gadgets. You jam, right? Sometimes I forget that all my friends don't know that Marcus, this is the narrator, and Mikey, this is his hacker alter ego, M1K3EY, Marcus and Mikey are the same person. Yeah, a little, I said. This is like jamming, but with a bunch of awesome bands. I see, I said. Mission burritos are an institution. They are cheap, giant, and delicious. Imagine a tube the size of a bazooka shell filled with spicy grilled meat, guacamole, salsa, tomatoes, refried beans, rice, onions, and cilantro. It has the same relationship to Taco Bell that a Lamborghini has to a Hot Wheels car. There are about 200 Mission burrito joints. They're all heroically ugly, with uncomfortable seats, minimal decor, faded Mexican tourist office posters, and electrified Jesus and Mary holograms, and loud mariachi music. The thing that distinguishes them mostly is what kind of exotic meat they fill their wares with. The really authentic places have brains and tongue and cheek, which I never order, but it's nice to know it's there. The place we went to had brains and tongue and cheek, which we didn't order. I got carne asada and she got shredded chicken, and we each got a big cup of horchata. As soon as we sat down, she unrolled her burrito and took a little bottle out of her purse. It was a little stainless steel aerosol canister that looked for all the world like a pepper spray self-defense unit. She aimed it at her burrito's exposed guts and misted them with a fine, oily red spray. I caught a whiff of it and my throat closed and my eyes watered. "What the hell are you doing to that poor defenseless burrito?" She gave me a wicked smile. "I'm a spicy food addict," she said. "It's capsaicin oil and a mister." Capsaicin? Yeah, it's stuff in pepper spray. This is like pepper spray, but slightly more dilute and way more delicious. Think of it as spicy Cajun Visine, if that helps. My eyes burned just thinking of it. "You're kidding," I said. "You are not going to eat that." Her eyebrows shot up. "That sounds like a challenge, Sonny. You just watch me." She rolled the burrito up as carefully as a stoner rolling a joint, tucking the ends in, then rewrapping it in tinfoil. She peeled off one end and brought it up to her mouth, poised with it just before her lips. Right up to the time she bit into it, I couldn't believe that she was going to do it. I mean, that was basically an anti-personnel weapon she just slathered on her dinner. She bit into it, chewed, swallowed, gave every impression of having a delicious dinner. "Want a bite?" she said, innocently. "Yeah," I said. "After all, I like spicy food. I always order the curries with four chilies next to them at the on the menu at the Pakistani place." I peeled back more foil and took a big bite. Big mistake. You know that feeling you get when you take a bite of horseradish or wasabi or whatever, and it feels like your sinuses are closing at the same time as your windpipe, filling your head with trapped, nuclear hot air that tries to batter its way out through your watering eyes and nostrils? That feeling like steam is about to pour out of your ears like a cartoon character? This was a lot worse. This was like putting your hand on a hot stove, only it's not your hand, it's the entire inside of your head and your esophagus all the way down to your stomach. My entire body sprang out in a sweat, and I choked and choked. Wordlessly, she passed me my horchata, and I managed to get the straw into my mouth and suck hard on it, gulping down half of it in one go. "So," she said, "there's a scale, the Scoville scale, that we chili fanciers, we use it to talk about how spicy a pepper is. Pure capsaicin is about 15 million Scovilles. Tabasco is about 2,500. Pepper spray is a healthy 3 million. This stuff is like a puny 100,000, about as hot as a mild Scotch bonnet pepper. I worked up to it in about a year. Some of the real hardcores can get up to 500,000, 200 times hotter than Tabasco. That's pretty freaking hot. At Scovilles like that, your brain gets totally awash in endorphins. It's a better body stone than hash, and it's good for you." I was getting my sinuses back now, able to breathe without gasping. "Of course," she said. "You do get a ferocious ring of fire when you go to the John." She winked at me. "Youch." "You are insane," I said. "Fine talk from a man whose hobby is building and smashing laptops." This is reference to a cryptographic protocol they did in the last chapter, she said. "Touché," I said, and touched my forehead. "Want some?" She held out her mister. "Pass," I said quickly enough that we both laughed. When we left the restaurant and headed for Dolores Park, she put her arm around my waist, and I found that she was just the right height for me to put my arm around her shoulders. That was new. I'd never been a tall guy, and the girls I dated had all been my height. Teenage girls grow faster than guys, which is a cruel trick of nature. This was nice. This felt nice. We turned the corner on 20th Street and walked up toward Dolores. Before we'd taken a single step, we could feel the buzz. It was like the hum of a million bees. There were lots of people streaming towards the park, but when I looked toward it, I saw that it was about 100 times more crowded than it had been when I went to meet Ange. That sight made my blood run hot. It was a beautiful, cool night, and we were about to party, really party, party like there was no tomorrow, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Without saying anything, we both broke into a trot. There were lots of cops with tense faces, but what the hell were they going to do? There were a lot of people in the park. I'm not so good at estimating crowds. The papers later quoted organizers as saying there were 20,000 people there. The cops said 5,000. Maybe that meant there were 12,500. Whatever. It was more people than I'd ever stood among as part of an unscheduled, unsanctioned, illegal event. We were among them in an instant. I can't swear to it, but I don't think there was anyone over 25 in the press of bodies. Everyone was smiling. Some young kids were there, 10 or 12, and that made me feel happier. Made me feel better. No one would do anything too stupid with kids that little in the crowd. No one wanted to see little kids get hurt. this was just going to be a glorious spring night of celebration. I figured the thing to do was push in towards the tennis courts. We threaded our way through the crowd, and to stay together, we took each other's hands. Only staying together didn't require us to intertwine fingers. That was strictly for pleasure, and it was very pleasurable. The bands were all inside the tennis courts with their guitars and mixers and keyboards, even a drum kit. Later on XNet, this is the shadow internet he's built out of hacked Xboxes. later on XNet, I found a Flickr stream of them smuggling all this stuff in, piece by piece, in gym bags and under their coats. Along with it were huge speakers, the kind you see in automotive supply places, and among them, a stack of car batteries. I laughed. Genius! That was how they were going to power their stacks. From where I stood, I could see that there were cells from a hybrid car, a Prius. Someone had gutted an eco-mobile to power the night's entertainment. The batteries continued outside the courts, stacked up against the fence, tethered to the main stack by wires threaded through the chain link. I counted 200 batteries. Christ, those things weighed a ton, too. There's no way they organized this without email and wikis and mailing lists, and there's no way people this smart would have done that on the public internet. This had all taken place on the XNet. I'd bet my boots on it. We just kind of bounced around in the crowd for a while as the bands tuned up and conferred with one another. I saw Trudy Dew from a distance in the tennis courts. She looked like she was in a cage, like a pro wrestler. She was wearing a torn wife beater, and her hair was in long, fluorescent pink dreads down to her waist. She was wearing army camouflage pants and giant gothy boots with steel overtoes. As I watched, she picked up a heavy motorcycle jacket, as worn as a catcher's mitt, and put it on like armor. It probably was armor, I realized. I tried to wave at her to impress Ange, I guess, but she didn't see me, and I kind of looked like a spaz, so I stopped. The energy in the crowd was amazing. You hear people talk about vibes and energy for big groups of people, but until you've experienced it, you probably think it's just a figure of speech. It's not. It's the smiles, infectious and big as watermelons, on every face, everyone bopping a little to an unheard rhythm, shoulders rocking, rolling walks, jokes and laughs, the tone of every voice tight and excited like a firework about to go off, and you can't help but be a part of it, because you are. By the time the bands kicked off, I was utterly stoned on crowd vibe. The opening act was some kind of Serbian turbo folk, which I couldn't figure out how to dance to. I know how to dance to exactly two kinds of music, trance, shuffle around and let the music move you, and punk, bash around and mosh until you get hurt or exhausted, or both. The next act were Oakland hip-hoppers backed by a thrash metal band, which is better than it sounds, then some bubblegum pop. Then Speed Horse took the stage, and Trudy Dew stepped up to the mic. My name is Trudy Dew, and you're an idiot if you trust me. I'm 32 and it's too late for me. I'm lost. I'm stuck in the old way of thinking. I still take my freedom for granted and let other people take it away from me. You're the first generation to grow up in Gulag America, and you know what your freedom is worth to the last goddamn cent. The crowd roared. She was playing fast little skittery nervous chords on her guitar, and her bass player, a huge fat girl with a butchy haircut and even bigger boots and a smile you could open beer bottles with, was laying it down fast and hard already. I wanted to bounce. I bounced. Ange bounced with me. We were sweating freely in the evening, which reeked of perspiration and pot smoke. Warm bodies crushed in on all sides of us. They bounced, too. "Don't trust anyone over 25," she shouted. We roared. We were one big animal throat, roaring. "Don't trust anyone over 25! Don't trust anyone over 25! Don't trust anyone over 25! She banged some hard chords on her guitar, and the other guitarist, a little pixie of a girl whose face bristled with piercings jammed in, going wheedledy 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 dee up high past that 12th fret. "It's our goddamn city. It's our goddamn country. No terrorist can take it from us for as long as we're free. Once we're not free, the terrorists win. Take it back. Take it back. You're young enough and stupid enough not to know that you can't possibly win, so you're the only ones who can lead us to victory. Take it back. Take it back," we roared. She jammed on hard on her guitar. We roared the note back to her, and then it got really loud. I danced until I was so tired I couldn't dance another step. Ange danced alongside of me. Technically, we were rubbing our sweaty bodies against each other for several hours, but believe it or not, I totally wasn't being a horn dog about it. We were dancing, lost in that god beat and the thrash and the screaming, "Take it back, take it back." When I couldn't dance anymore, I grabbed her hand and she squeezed mine like I was keeping her from falling off a building. She dragged me toward the edge of the crowd where it got thinner and cooler. Out there, on the edge of Dolores Park, we were in the cool air and the sweat on our bodies went instantly icy. We shivered and she threw her arms around my waist. "Warm me," she commanded. I didn't need a hint. I hugged her back. Her heart was an echo of the fast beats from the stage, breakbeats now, fast and furious and wordless. She smelled of sweat, a sharp tang that smelled great. I knew I smelled of sweat, too. My nose was pointed into the top of her head, and her face was right at my collarbone. She moved her hands to my neck and tugged. "Get down here. I didn't bring a stepladder," is what she said. And I tried to smile, but it's hard to smile when you're kissing. Like I said, I kissed three girls in my life. Two of them had never kissed anyone before. One had been dating since she was 12. She had issues. None of them kissed like Ange. She made her whole mouth soft like the inside of a ripe piece of fruit, and she didn't jam her tongue in my mouth, but slid it in there and sucked my lips into her mouth at the same time, so it was like my mouth and hers were merging. I heard myself moan, and I grabbed her and squeezed her harder. Slowly, gently, we lowered ourselves to the grass. We lay on our sides and clutched each other, kissing and kissing. The world disappeared so that there was only that kiss. My hands found her butt and her waist, the edge of her t-shirt, her warm tummy, her soft navel. They inched higher. She moaned, too. "Not here," she said. "Let's move over there." She pointed across the street to the big white church that gives Mission Dolores Park and the mission its name. Holding hands, moving quickly, we crossed to the church. It had big pillars in front of it. She put my back up against one of them and pulled my face down to hers again. My hands went boldly and quickly back to her shirt. I slipped them up her front. "It undoes in the back," she whispered in my mouth. I had a boner that could cut glass. I moved my hands around to her back, which was strong and broad, and found the hook with my fingers, which were trembling. I fumbled for a while, thinking of all those jokes about how bad guys are at undoing bras. I was bad at it. Then the hook sprang free, she gasped into my mouth, and I slipped my hands around, feeling the wetness of her armpits, which was sexy and not at all gross for some reason, and then brushed the sides of her breasts. And that's when the sirens started. They were louder than anything I'd ever heard, a sound like a physical sensation, like something blowing you off your feet, a sound as loud as your ears could process, and then louder. "Disperse immediately," a voice said, like God rattling in my skull. "This is an illegal gathering. Disperse immediately." The band had stopped playing. The noise of the crowd across the street changed. It got scared, angry. I heard a click as the PA system of car speakers and car batteries in the tennis courts powered up. "Take it back!" It was a defiant yell like a sound shouted into the surf or screamed off a cliff. "Take it back!" The crowd growled, a sound that made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. "Take it back!" they chanted. "Take it back! Take it back! Take it back!" The police moved in lines, carrying plastic shields, wearing Darth Vader helmets that covered their faces. Each one had a black truncheon and infrared goggles. They looked like soldiers out of some futuristic war movie. They took a step forward in unison, and every one of them banged his truncheon on his shield, a cracking noise like the earth splitting. Another step, another crack. They were all around the park and closing in now. "Disperse immediately," the voice of God said again. There were helicopters overhead now. No floodlights. Of course, the infrared goggles. They'd have infrared scopes in the sky, too. I pulled Ange back against the doorway of the church, tucking us back from the cops and the choppers. "Take it back," the PA roared. It was Trudy Dew's rebel yell, and I heard her guitar thrash out some chords, then her drummer playing, then that big, deep bass. "Take it back," the crowd answered, and they boiled out of the park at the police lines. I've never been in a war. But now I think I know what it must be like. What it must be like when the scared kids charge across a field at an opposing force, knowing what's coming, running anyways, screaming, howling. "Disperse immediately," the voice of God said. It was coming from trucks parked all around the park, trucks that had swung into place in the last few seconds. And that's when the mist fell. It came out of the choppers, and we just caught the edge of it. It made the top of my head feel like it was going to come off. It made my sinuses feel like they were being punctured with ice picks. It made my eyes swell and water and my throat close. Pepper spray. Not 100,000 Scovilles, 1.5 million. They'd gassed the crowd. I didn't see what happened next, but I heard it, over the sound of both me and Ange choking and holding each other. First the choking, retching sounds, the guitar and drums and bass crashed to a halt, then coughing, then screaming. The screaming went on for a long time. When I could see again, the cops had their scopes up on their foreheads and the choppers were flooding Dolores Park with so much light, it looked like daylight. Everyone was looking at the park, which was good news, because when the lights went up like that, we were totally visible. "What do we do?" Ange said. Her voice was tight, scared. I didn't trust myself to speak for a minute. I swallowed a few times. "We walk away," I said. "That's all we can do. Walk away like we were just passing by. Down to Dolores and turn left and up towards 16th Street like we were just passing by. Like this is none of our business." "That'll never work," she said. "It's all I've got." "You don't think we should try and run for it?" "No," I said. "If we run, they'll chase us. Maybe if we walk, they'll figure we haven't done anything and let us alone. They have a lot of arrests to make. They'll be busy for a long time." The park was rolling with bodies, people and adults clawing at their faces and gasping. The cops dragged them by the armpits, then lashed their wrists with plastic cuffs and tossed them into the trucks like rag dolls. "Okay," I said. "Okay," she said. And that's just what we did. Walked, holding hands, quickly and businesslike, like two people wanting to avoid whatever trouble someone else was making. The kind of walk you adopt when you want to pretend you can't see a panhandler or don't want to get involved in a street fight. It worked. We reached the corner and turned and kept on going. Neither of us dared to speak for two blocks. Then I let out a gasp of air I hadn't known I'd been holding in. We came to 16th Street and turned down toward Mission Street. That's normally a pretty scary neighborhood at 2 a.m. on a Saturday. That night it was a relief. Same old druggies and hookers and dealers and drunks. No cops with truncheons. No pepper spray. I said as we breathed in the night's air. "Coffee?" "Home," she said. "I think home for now. Coffee later." "Yeah," I agreed. She lived up in Hayes Valley. I spotted a taxi rolling by and I hailed it. That was a small miracle. There are hardly any cabs when you need them in San Francisco. "Have you got cab fare home?" "Yeah," she said. The cab driver looked at us through his window. I opened the back door so he couldn't take off. "Good night," I said. She put her hands behind my head and pulled my face towards her. She kissed me hard on the mouth. Nothing sexual in it, but somehow more intimate for that. "Good night," she whispered in my ear and slipped into the taxi. Head swimming, eyes running, a burning shame for having left all those ex-netters to the tender mercy of the DHS and the SFPD, I set off for home.